emergency use among four vaccines that are being developed in Iran to tackle the pandemic. Iran has also announced that it's going to be ready to ship the vaccines in a few months. What do you think?
Well, I believe vaccines are among the most strategic products in any country. So you look at Iran's situation in the past 4 years, and you see, Iran was under a lot of pressure. Iranian people suffered a lot because of sanctions and because they were not able to get their hands on important equipment, medical equipment, and important medicines fast enough. Right now, Western countries, especially the United States, claim that, without sanctions, do not apply on specific stuff like medicines. But the fact is, when a country is under a lot of pressure, under so many sanctions, and under the so-called maximum pressure policy, any kind of purchase would be delayed. No kind of purchase can be fast enough, especially when it comes to important medical stuff.
Okay. Well, Ahmad, let me come to you. I'm gonna address this in a different way in terms of what Iran can do. Ready to supply the Coviran Barakat vaccine. It has been approved, as I mentioned, by the country's health ministry for emergency use. And Coviran Barakat is the top candidate among four vaccines being developed in Iran to tackle the coronavirus pandemic. Announced also Iran to be ready to ship the vaccines in a matter of months. Doesn't this break any idea of how Europe or the U.S. maybe has a monopoly on this?
Well, it shatters that idea that only developed or industrialized countries have a monopoly over the vaccine and its production. We have to congratulate Iran and other countries such as Cuba and other developing countries who have advanced in developing their vaccines. However, here is important note to make that while Barakat is being spearheaded for Iran to vaccinate the population, there is other mechanisms to be able to speed the distribution of vaccines to the population of Iran in addition to Barakat of other vaccines that are in development. So I think that while Iran has showcased to the international community that under extreme conditions of sanctions, of economic hardship, and the pandemic itself, it's been able to make this breakthrough. But I believe that it is also we know that Iran has also indicated that when it goes into mass production for the Barakat vaccine, that it's open to providing it to other countries. Now, this is phenomenal, because a country that is already in dire situation is still saying that if we are able to make this vaccine at a high level in production, we will be open to providing you, other countries, low-income countries, with this vaccination.
This is our InfoNews section, where we inform you of other economic news from around the world. First up, let's take a look at this piece of news that caught our attention. It's based on the G7, and it's the G7 anti-China stance. In their final communique, they rallied around the need to counter and to compete with China. One way of doing this, the G7 aims to counter Xi's Belt and Road Initiative. It's known as the Build Back Better World, B3W for short. Price tag, $40 trillion. To counter China's Belt and Road Initiative. Let's see if that works out. Where's the money going to come from? Okay, next up, the world's displaced, very important topic. Global displaced population hits an all-time high. At this point, that all-time high is roughly around 82 million, as you're about to see. This figure of 82 million, which is the number of displaced, just came out in the most recent report. And that article said that it's a tragedy how so many children are being born into exile. That obviously needs more of an effort to prevent and to end conflict and violence. And it's been called an epic failure of humanity because it's one of the highest numbers. All right, next up, the topic, child labor setback. Why? Because the U.S. High Court actually it's really something to be worried about, because the U.S. High Court has sided with corporate giants, in this case, Nestle and Cargill. And that is a child slavery case. The lawyers for the plaintiffs have argued that Nestle and Cargill have total control over the production of coca in Côte d'Ivoire, where child labor is very widespread. Moving on to our final story, it's another, actually, court case, this one happening in Brazil. A bill backed by the country's farm sector would limit the recognition of reservation lands. The legislation, it was first tabled back in the year 2007, and that would actually assign the year 1988 as the cutoff date for the demarcation of reservation lands if they were not occupied at that time. This has been called an unacceptable setback for indigenous rights, especially for their lands. So here we are. As we speak, people are dying by the minute around the world. This is the WHO chief speaking just on June 15th.
During this press conference alone, more than 420 people will die.
Quite shocking, isn't it? Let's not forget another alarming factor, variants. They are popping up around the world. So, on the one hand, you have the COVID-19, and then you have the variants as well. Then you have countries that have had the first jab, but not the second one yet. And if they don't get it in time, well, then they're going to be susceptible to catching the disease. And then you have countries like the US, UK, or the G7 bloc saying that they will pledge 1 billion doses, worried about patents and money. I ask you, do they see the severity of the situation? What is truly surprising is that they don't even see how this vaccine hoarding hurts their own pockets. Many of these developing nations are have the headquarters of the factories in these developing countries which produce their products, from clothes to you name it. Now, Iran is ramping up its production of Coviran Barakat, and God willing, it will reach a volume enough for worldwide distribution. The U.S. needs to remove its sanctions, however, to save human lives, if that is something that figures in its calculations. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. Your questions and comments are always welcome. Thanks for being with us for this edition. From Miko Vitaloy and the entire team, it's goodbye.
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of عمل انسان بعد از ایمان.
Self purification is the most significant fact.
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام.
امامت is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by famous Iranian Shiite orator and lecturer, Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
Thank you. توی مسجدی، مسجد محلش بود، میرفت برای نماز جماعت. یه مرتبه رفت.
Once a man went to the bathroom of a mosque to take wudu or ablution. He saw the imam of the mosque who went to the toilet and after some seconds left the toilet and went straight to the mosque and lead the congregational prayer. Upon visiting this scene, the man thought to himself that the imam is a corrupted man because he went to the toilet and without wudu, he went to lead the prayer. The man left the mosque and did not pray behind that imam. He narrated this event for others, and after some days, the rumors of the imam without wudu was everywhere. The imam heard the rumors behind himself and left the town because he was not welcomed by the people as before. The man who discovered this event was proud with himself and boasted here and there that I was such and such person who found the corrupted imam.
چند مدت گذشت، اون بنده خدا رفته بود درمانگاهی آمپول زده بود، بعد اومد مسجد.
Several months passed. The same person became sick and went to the hospital to have an injection. When he got back, it was the salat time, so he went to the bathroom to find whether the injection blood made him najas or impure or not, because he had wudu already. All of a sudden, he remembered the imam of the mosque, and he thought to himself, maybe on that day, the imam went to the toilet of the bathroom to check the same thing, that is, the blood of the injection, to see whether he can do salat with the same wudu or not. At this time, he made a loud and deep sigh from inside and repented for what he did. He told himself, "Oh Allah, how can I now save the face of the imam who left this town for the rumors which I made behind him? Now, till the day of judgment, I have to look for that imam and ask for his forgiveness. I disgraced the imam, and there is no way to ask for forgiveness unless I find the imam and ask him directly for forgiveness." Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Fi amanallah.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Tensions in the Black Sea are on the rise after a British Navy warship breached Russian territorial waters off the Crimean coast on Wednesday. Russian Defense Ministry said in a statement that Russia's Black Sea Fleet and the Russian Federal Security Service had stopped the violation of the state border by the British destroyer HMS Defender off Crimea's Cape Fyland. According to the ministry, the British military vessel ventured 3 kilometers into Russian territorial waters, prompting a Russian border guard patrol ship to fire warning shots and a Sukhoi 24M bomber to drop bombs in front of the destroyer. Following the warning maneuvers, the HMS Defender left the waters, but the British side denied that warning shots had been fired and that any bombs had been dropped in the path of the HMS Defender. Earlier in the day, Russia said hostile actions by the British warship near Russian territorial waters could not have been carried out without the U.S. green light.
I mean, in the sense that the U.S. and the U.K. are sending their fleet far away from home and obviously making provocative actions that are directly related to their interference in the internal affairs of Ukraine, yes, of course, the United States and the U.K. are guilty of these kinds of unwarranted provocations intended to create pressure on Russia. However, the fact of the matter is that these kinds of incidents are relatively common, and they can be expected. What the only unusual part here is that Russia is not backing down and is not giving in to the British pressure.
Russia has warned that it will defend its borders by all means, including with its military. Russia's foreign ministry has summoned the British ambassador to strongly protest what it called the British ship's violation of its territory. The ministry said it delivered a strongly worded protest to the envoy over the British Navy ship's, quote, provocative and dangerous actions. It said London would be fully responsible for any consequences if a similar incident happened again. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, however, defended the Navy ship's decision to navigate inside the Russian waters.
I think it was wholly appropriate to use international waters. And by the way, the important point is that we don't recognize the Russian annexation of Crimea. This is part of a sovereign Ukrainian territory. It was entirely right that we should vindicate the law and pursue freedom of navigation in the way that we take the shortest route between two points, and that's what we did.
Earlier this month, Russia announced a plan to boost its military presence along its western borders to counter increased NATO activities there. In the meantime, NATO has pressed ahead with its military drills near the Russian ground and maritime borders, a move that Moscow deems provocative.
The frequency with which the NATO, let's refer to the United States and the UK as the key NATO powers, the frequency at which they are doing this and the directness of their approach. There's no pretend here that there was an accident. This is an intentional heightening of military tensions, and it is intentional.
It appears that another Cold War between Russia and the West is likely to be on the horizon. The possible crisis, however, could prove even costlier than the first for both sides.
Generations of horrific abuse of Indigenous people in Canada once again under the spotlight. A First Nations group in Saskatchewan province has revealed that the remains of hundreds of people, mostly children, were discovered at the site of a former Catholic boarding school there. Local Indigenous leaders want an inquiry into what they call genocide. The First Nations group said that the church that ran the residential school removed the headstones. The piece of tragic news came just weeks after the discovery of the remains of over 200 Indigenous children rattled the country. The latest finds have reopened old wounds in Canada about the notorious residential schools mostly operated by the Roman Catholic Church for the government of Canada. During the 19th and 20th centuries, 130 boarding schools forcibly separated more than 150,000 indigenous children from their families. The program was aimed at assimilating indigenous youth, but the schools subjected them to malnutrition and physical and sexual abuse. An estimated 6,000 First Nation kids died while attending these schools. Under mounting pressure, the Canadian government formally apologized for the system in 2008. However, despite growing calls, the Pope and the Roman Catholic Church have refused to apologize.
They're abrogating their responsibilities. By admitting their crimes, they're admitting that they're not following their own teachings. The crimes that they committed are so horrific, and children were beaten for simply speaking their own languages.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said on Thursday that he was terribly saddened by the new discovery. He said the trauma that Indigenous people feel is Canada's responsibility to bear. But has Ottawa really learned a lesson, and is it serious about alleviating the plight of First Nations? Canada is ranked among the world's seven largest advanced economies. The modern country, with one of the highest GDPs in the world, has long been a popular destination for millions of immigrants from across the globe seeking jobs and a better life. While Canada may sound like a dream world to many, it is far from a utopia for its own indigenous population. Canada's 1.7 million indigenous citizens, nearly 5% of the population, mostly live in isolated communities where poverty, high unemployment, and high rates of suicide are chronic problems.
There are psychological problems that have been passed down from generation to generation. Fathers who were in the generations in the residential schools and mothers suffered severe psychological problems because of the treatment they received, and that's just been passed down from generation to generation. And it's going to take years to correct that.
They have long complained that they are not getting a fair share of incomes from resources on their ancestral lands. Meanwhile, Aboriginal women have been subjected to deadly violence for many years. A national public inquiry concluded a few years ago that about 1,200 Aboriginal women had been murdered or gone missing in Canada since 1980, with activists putting the number much higher. Human rights groups have repeatedly raised the alarm about the situation of Canada's indigenous population. Canada says it is ashamed of systemic racism, discrimination, and injustice that Indigenous peoples have faced. In 2017, the Canadian government acknowledged the humiliation, neglect, and abuse of First Nations and pledged to improve their lives. But First Nations are still struggling with a long list of problems and are fighting an uphill battle for their rights.
The United States has launched a wide-scale cyber crackdown on the websites of major news networks, mainly based in West Asia. In what appears to have been a coordinated operation, the domain for the websites was seized at a similar time late Tuesday night. Viewers visiting the sites have been met with the same notice from the U.S. Department of Commerce and the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which reads, "This website has been seized. The domain has been seized by the United States government." The alleged legislation stated in the notice is too vague and wide to pinpoint exactly why the sites have been targeted. According to the U.S. Department of Justice, a total of 36 websites have been seized. Among the most prominent websites of news networks that have been targeted are Iranian-based news channels Press TV, Al Alam, and Al Kothar. In Yemen, the popular Al Masira news outlet that has been documenting Saudi Arabia's war on the country, along with other regional developments, has also been seized. Palestine Today is another, and the website of Lu'lu'a TV, an independent Bahraini news channel, Canal was also captured. Washington took control of sites linked to news channels based in Iraq, too. These are mainly associated with the country's most important anti-terrorism security force, the Popular Mobilization Forces, the same branch of the Iraqi armed forces that spearheaded their victory against Daesh terrorists from 2014 to 2017. This has left many asking, where is America's so-called free speech and democracy?
This is not something that we should share. Somehow, it looks like freedom of expression and free speech has become the enemy rather than being or ally. And now the U.S. is blocking sites that are trying to provide information, that are trying to give another perspective and other view of the events that are happening worldwide.
All the news channels whose sites have been seized share something similar. Their narrative is different to that of news channels belonging to the United States and its allies. For example, they offered another side of the story to events unfolding in Yemen or Palestine. But how dangerous can that be when the United States does not provide viewers an alternative narrative to the news?
This is very dangerous. Without allowing other views and other narratives, the public cannot make, cannot make their minds. They cannot really understand the complexity of issues and have their own opinion about what is happening. Another danger is that we are in danger of manipulating, the information, manipulating reality.
Iranian-based websites are online like before under the domain .ir. For example, you can visit Press TV at presstv.ir. Yemen's Al-Masira.net was quick to open a new working website at almasira.com. Other channels are expected to follow suit in a similar fashion by changing their domain name. Iranian presidential office says closing a number of our news websites is an unconstructive measure in light of the Vienna nuclear negotiations. Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Saeed Khatibzadeh denounced the move as a systematic attempt by the U.S. to undermine freedom of expression on a global level and to silence independent voices in media. The Tehran-based Islamic Radios and Television Union says the U.S. seizure of dozens of websites is a shameful attack on rights of people across the world. The owners of the popular Ansar Allah movement have condemned the U.S. move, saying it signifies that these TV networks are influential and their activities have frightened the hegemonic regimes that claim to be advocates of freedom of speech. Critics say the U.S. administration's campaign to portray Iran and others in West Asia as destabilizing players in the region is aimed at benefiting America's military-industrial complex. They also say democracies should allow all voices to be heard and offer the viewer an opportunity to choose which narrative they wish to listen to.
The United Nations has blacklisted Yemen's Ansarullah, accusing it of violating children's rights. The move has drawn Yemen's ire. Yemen's political leadership has blamed the world body for its apathy towards the continued Saudi violations against the children of Yemen. Yemeni officials say the UN should play its role to lift the Saudi blockade on Yemenis that's killing children instead of blacklisting the Ansarullah movement. Member of the Supreme Political Council, Mohammed al-Houthi, dismissed as baseless the UN accusation, saying it did not refer to an investigation on the ground as the movement had demanded. Meanwhile, Yemen's Minister of Information said the UN had turned a blind eye to the ongoing Saudi blockade and attacks on Yemenis, which have led to the death of tens of Yemeni children on a daily basis.
I think it's a political decision by the part of the United Nations. They're being faced with pressure from the United States, Britain, and France, who are making billions of dollars selling arms to Saudi Arabia and to the United Arab Emirates. And in addition, I think it may have been part of a concession for the re-election of the current Secretary General for the United Nations, who just was re-elected. So it's clearly political, it's not fair, and it points to the fact that the United Nations is losing its utility and is becoming sort of a pawn in the part of the Western powers, in particular the United States.
Observers say the United Nations blacklisting of Ansarullah has no relation to the humanitarian situation in Yemen. They believe that the UN must take real action against the Saudi blockade if it has real intentions to end the suffering of millions of Yemenis. Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015. The war has killed thousands of civilians, including women and children. Yemen is now dealing with what the United Nations has called the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The UN added the Saudi-led coalition to its blacklist of violators of children's rights in 2016, a move that was soon reversed by former UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Ban Ki-moon said he delisted the coalition after he faced pressure from a number of Saudi Arabia's allies that threatened to cut crucial funding to many UN programs.
This was one of the most painful and difficult decisions I have had to make. The report describes horrors no child should have to face. At the same time, I also had to consider the very real prospect that millions of other children would suffer grievously if, as was suggested to me, countries would defund many UN programs.
The move drew angry reactions from human rights activists who said the UN Secretary General's office had hit a new low. Last year, the UN removed the coalition from its blacklist, citing a decline in the number of those killed and maimed in Yemen.
I would say that the Saudis and some of their rich allies would be threatening the United Nations to withdraw funding. Under Donald Trump, they did withdraw funding for the UN, and Biden has restored it, but I suspect that there was some hidden agenda on it that they still want to support Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and don't like the fact that the Ansar movement and the Shias in Yemen like to be independent and not be dictated to by the Saudis and indirectly by the United States and its allies.
The Saudi-led coalition's blockade and its war on Yemen continue to claim millions of innocent lives. The United Nations has a responsibility to help end people's suffering. Taking a one-sided approach to conflicts will never resolve them.
The limelight. Former U.S. President Donald Trump's first impeachment for abusing his power in approaches to Ukraine attracted one Republican vote, that of the Utah Senator Mitt Romney. In his second, for inciting the deadly U.S. Capitol attack, 10 House Republicans and 7 in the Senate voted for Trump's guilt. We now present you an article written by Martin Pengelly. Under the heading, Donald Trump returns to campaign trail with rally targeting Ohio Republicans. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Former U.S. President Donald Trump returned to the campaign trail with a rally in Ohio on Saturday night, 26th of June, campaigning against the Republican who voted for his impeachment and trailing his own candidacy for president in 2024. Trump repeated his baseless election 2020 grievances and painted a dystopian picture of the country under Democratic control, while in another echo of the past, the crowd chanted "Lock her up" at the mention of Hillary Clinton, the Democrat he defeated back in 2016. The rally outside Cleveland, Ohio, on Saturday, 26th of June, was to support Max Miller, a former White House aide challenging Anthony Gonzalez, a former college football and NFL star censured by his state party for voting for Donald Trump's impeachment. While he praised Miller as an incredible patriot and a so-called great guy who purportedly loves the people of Ohio, Trump spent much of the rally fixating on the 2020 presidential election, which he insists he won. This is despite top state and local election officials, his own attorney general, and numerous judges, including some that he had appointed himself, saying there is no evidence of the mass voter fraud that Trump alleges took place. He told the crowd, which at one point broke into a Trump won chant, the 2020 presidential election was rigged. He added, "We won that election in a landslide." When Marjorie Taylor Greene, a far-right Republican from Georgia known for her incendiary rhetoric, asked the crowd who their president is, they boomed loudly, "Trump." She said, "President Trump is my president too." The event had many of the trappings of the rallies Donald Trump held as a candidate and as president. There was the eclectic playlist, the same stage design, and many familiar volunteers. In the lead-up to the event, Donald Trump told a conservative Newsmax channel, "We're giving tremendous endorsements. Fake Republicans, anybody that voted for the impeachment doesn't get it, but there weren't too many of them. And I think most of them are being primaried right now, so that's good. I'll be helping their opponent." Donald Trump's first impeachment for abusing his power in approaches to Ukraine attracted one Republican vote, that of Utah Senator Mitt Romney. In his second impeachment for inciting the deadly U.S. Capitol attack, 10 House Republicans and 7 in the Senate voted for Trump's guilt. Donald Trump was acquitted twice, but banned from major social media platforms over his role in the Capitol attack. Regardless, he dominates the Republican Party. All bar one of the House Republicans who voted against him have attracted challengers. The 10th, John Katko of New York, co-authored a proposal for an independent 9/11-style commission to investigate the 6th of January attack on Congress, in which a mob roamed the Capitol looking for lawmakers to capture or kill in an attempt to overturn the election result. Senate Republicans blocked it. By Saturday afternoon, traffic was backed up from the fairgrounds into town, where pro-Trump signs dotted residents' lawns. On street corners, vendors sold Trump 2024 flags and other merchandise as supporters arrived. Marjorie Taylor Greene, a far-right congresswoman from Georgia who was stripped of her committee assignments over a number of extreme comments, mingled with attendees and took pictures. Donald Trump has said he didn't win the election, but has not formally conceded defeat by Joe Biden, and continues to voice his lie that the loss was the result of electoral fraud. On Friday, he told Newsmax he would be making an announcement in the not-too-distant future about whether he will run again, and said supporters were going to be thrilled by election results in 2024. He said, "We want a little time to go by, maybe watch what happens in 2022. In 2022 midterm elections, Republicans hope to retake the House and the Senate. Donald Trump's legal problems mounted on Friday, 25th of June, as his own lawyer confirmed that charges are likely in the investigation of the Trump Organization by the Manhattan District Attorney. The company's chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, and the company itself are in prosecutors' sights. Some observers point out that Donald Trump's many legal problems did not stop him winning the presidency back in 2016 and are unlikely to put off many Republican voters should he run again for the White House. In his Newsmax interview, the former president referred to his problems and to those affecting Rudy Giuliani, Donald Trump's lawyer and loyal ally. The former New York mayor this week saw his law license suspended over his advancement of Donald Trump's election fraud lie. Trump said, "Right now, I'm helping a lot of people get into office, and we're fighting the deep state, and we're fighting the radical left. They're after me. They're after Rudy. They're after you, probably. They're after anybody." The deep state conspiracy theory holds that a permanent government of bureaucrats and operatives exists to thwart Donald Trump. Steve Bannon, Trump's campaign chairman in 2016, then a White House strategist and chief propagator of the theory, has said it is for nutcases. Donald Trump went on, "They're vicious, and they don't do a good job, and they're very bad for the country, but I've been fighting them for 5.5 years. He said, "Since I came down the escalator at Trump Tower in New York in June of 2015 to announce his run for president, I've been fighting them. These are vicious people. I honestly believe they don't love this country." Donald Trump has spent much of his post-presidency at his Florida resort and his golf course in New Jersey. He also told Newsmax he was working very hard, not only for 2024, but we're working very hard to show the corruption of what took place in 2020. And then we see what happens. Donald Trump's rallies have been an instrumental part of his brand since he launched his 2016 presidential campaign. The former president often test drives new material and talking points to see how they resonate with crowds. His political operation uses the events to collect critical voter contact information and as fundraising tools.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents. Humanity. Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. Previously, we were looking at Islam as a system, as a champion and as a hero for human rights, compared to other religions and other faiths. If we look at the Islamic laws, because sometimes you want to, you know, have a bit of comparison, look at what makes Islam special, what makes it the champion of human rights. I'm just giving a few examples here. For example, under the Islamic government, Allah says, and the Quran says, and the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam says, that what applies to a Muslim needs to apply to all, right? Whether you're a Muslim or non-Muslim. For example, when it comes to interest, or what we call riba, Islam came and forbid dealing and trading with anything that might give the person the surplus, which is what we call riba, interest. So Islam forbade interest, period, without an exception. If you would give someone a loan, you are not to ask for a profit, you are not to ask for anything extra, because that would be interest. And this law of interest applies to everybody, whether you are a Muslim, Christian, I don't know. This should not apply to you, because as Muslims, I am forbidden to deal with what? Interest. I cannot deal with riba. It doesn't matter who I'm dealing with. I cannot do it. Islam says riba is forbidden. The act itself is forbidden. It should not be done. Let's compare that to Judaism, for example. It says in the Torah, Old Testament, it says, do not give your brother a loan with interest, whether it is silver, food, or anything. Do not use interest with your fellow brother, which is fair enough, you know, sounds good. But then, right after it says, but if you deal with foreigners, then by all means, take interest. But for your brother, do not take interest. That is, you know, a massive difference between the Islamic law and the Judaism law, where it says, well, one says no interest to all the human beings because it's forbidden on you as a person to deal in such an act. Well, the other will say, no, no, it's fine. Between us, because we love each other, because we have the same faith, therefore we should not do interest on riba. But when we deal with others, then by all means, let us take everything from them. And this is just one formula, just one pillar that they use. For example, also if you look in chapter 6, verse 15 in the Torah, it says that the Jews, they give loans to many nations with interest, and they do not give interest to themselves. And this is exactly what is being applied today. So the World Bank now, it is controlled by the Jews. They would lend all other nations who need money with high amounts of interest. But when it comes to themselves, the Jews themselves, they give them loans without any interest. So they're applying that verse of the Bible, that verse of the Torah, the Old Testament, word by word. Where Islam says, the act itself is forbidden, doesn't matter who you're looking at. So I ask you, which one is more thorough here? The Islamic concept or the Judaism concept? Would you rather to have people not to deal and take interest from you, doesn't matter who you are, or people treat you based on what you believe? Let us take a break and inshallah we will continue.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are still listening to the program for humanity. Before the break, we were saying that in Islam, the laws themselves, they apply to everyone, which means that if Allah gives me an instruction, a command, and he says, do not deal with riba, interest, then I cannot deal with riba. Doesn't matter who it is I am talking to. Where in Judaism, for example, it says, do not deal with riba with your own kind, with Jews, but you can deal with riba with other than Jews. So that's just, you know, one thing. Again, and according to Judaism, for example, it says that if you've taken the right of somebody, and after a while, let's say after, I think this is 7 years, after 7 years, that it automatically cancels itself out. So for example, if a Jew borrows money from another Jew and he does not repay him in 7 years, that debt considered to be repaid and you're okay to go. But when it comes to a foreigner, let's say someone who's not a Jew and he borrows money from another Jew, if he hasn't paid it within 7 years or more, he still need to pay it back because he's not a Jew. But if he was a Jew, it will be nullified within 7 years. where this notion comes from the fact that in Judaism itself, especially if you look at the Old Bible, especially if you look at the Old Testament, the notion of afterlife does not exist, because they do not believe in afterlife yet, at least. They say, well, the gates have not been opened, therefore there is no afterlife. So which means what? Which means you can sin and you can get away with it because you don't believe in the afterlife anyway. As Islam says, if you take someone's right, if you borrow from someone's money, even if you don't give it back to them, it doesn't matter how long it is. It could be 7, 10, 50, 100 years. He could be your brother in faith, or he could be your enemy, or he could be someone from a different faith. It doesn't matter to Islam. He says, if you take their money, you need to give it back to them. If you don't, and repay it in this world, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will make sure on the day of judgment will make you pay for it in a way or another. Now, how Allah does that, that's a topic for another day. But he does what? He makes you pay for it. So it does not get nullified, it does not get cancelled, because that is the right of people. If someone takes money from me, he can't say to me, well, after 7 years, we cool. No, not such a thing. It's still my money, you're still taking my right. You don't want to give it back to me, I understand. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will deal with you accordingly on the day of judgment. So you see how simple laws differ from one faith to another that makes and plays a huge role in the life of people. And this is what we call human rights. This is the basic human rights that Allah says, do not deal with interest with people, and if you take someone's right, you need to give it back to them. Well, in Judaism, it is absolutely the opposite. It would work with Jews, but it does not work with non-Jews. So Islam is all about human rights and preserving that right for them. Well, inshallah, we will continue in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin. Ya Rabbi salli ala Muhammadin wa ali. Ya Rabbi salli ala Muhammadin wa ali.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
An indictment of the Trump Organization could mark the first criminal charges to emerge from an investigation by the Manhattan District Attorney into Donald J. Trump and his business dealings. The Manhattan District Attorney's office has informed Donald J. Trump's lawyers that it is considering criminal charges against his family business, the Trump Organization, in connection with fringe benefits the company awarded a top executive, according to several people with knowledge of the matter. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists William K. Rashbaum, Ben Protas, and Jonah E. Bromwich. The piece is titled, Trump Organization Could Face Criminal Charges in District Attorney Inquiry. An indictment of the Trump Organization could mark the first criminal charges to emerge from an investigation by Manhattan District Attorney into Donald J. Trump and his business dealings. The Manhattan District Attorney's office has informed Donald J. Trump's lawyers that it is considering criminal charges against his family business, the Trump Organization, in connection with fringe benefits the company awarded a top executive, according to several people with knowledge of the matter. The prosecutors had been building a case for months against the executive Alan H. Weisselberg as part of an effort to pressure him to cooperate with a broader inquiry into Donald Trump's business dealings. But it was not previously known that the Trump Organization also might face charges. If the case moves ahead, the district attorney, Cyrus R. Vance Jr., could announce charges as soon as next week, the people said. Mr. Vance's prosecutors have been conducting the investigation along with lawyers from the office of the New York State Attorney General, Letitia James. Any indictment would be the first to emerge from the long-running investigation and would raise the startling prospect of a former president having to defend the company he founded and has run for decades against accusations of criminal behavior. Prosecutors recently have focused much of their investigation into the perks that Donald Trump and the company doled out to Mr. Weisselberg and other executives, including tens of thousands of dollars in private school tuition for one of Mr. Weisselberg's grandchildren, as well as rents on apartments and car leases. They are looking into whether those benefits were properly recorded in the company's ledgers and whether taxes were paid on them, the New York Times has reported. Donald Trump's lawyers met on Thursday, 24th of June, with senior prosecutors in the district attorney's office in hope of persuading them to abandon any plan to charge the company, according to several people familiar with the meeting. Such meetings are routine in white-collar criminal investigations, and it is unclear whether the prosecutors have made a final decision on whether to charge the Trump Organization, which has long denied any wrongdoing. In my more than 50 years of practice, never before have I seen a district attorney's office target a company over employee compensation or fringe benefits, said Ronald P. Fischetti, a personal lawyer for Donald Trump. It's ridiculous and outrageous. Several lawyers who specialize in tax rules have told the New York Times that it would be highly unusual to indict a company just for failing to pay taxes on fringe benefits. None of them could cite any recent example, noting that many companies provide their employees with benefits like company cars. Still, an indictment of Donald Trump's company could deal a blow to the former president, just as he has started to hold rallies and flirt with a return to politics. The Trump Organization is inseparable from Mr. Trump, acting as a corporate umbrella for a portfolio of hotels, golf clubs, and other real estate, most of which are branded with his name. It is unclear whether Donald Trump will ultimately face charges himself. The investigation, which began 3 years ago, has been wide-ranging, examining whether the Trump Organization manipulated the value of its properties to obtain favorable loans and tax benefits, people with knowledge of the matter have said. The inquiry is also examining the organization's statements to insurance companies about the value of various assets and